The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I think that the OLC opinions are wrong. I mean, I remember looking at them then and thinking, you know, this notion that you can't indict the president essentially because you will paralyze, you know, the executive branch just doesn't, to me, hold water.
I'm David Chris.
And I'm Nate Jones. And this is the Culper Partners Rule of Law special series on the Lawfare podcast.
In this podcast series, we explore the rule of law, particularly as it relates to U.S. national security and criminal law enforcement.
Our guest today is Eric Holder. From 2009 to 2015, Mr. Holder served as the 82nd Attorney General of the United States. His long and distinguished career at the Department of Justice goes back even further. Earlier in his career, he spent 12 years in the public integrity section of the criminal division. After a stint in the judicial branch as a judge on the Superior Court of the District of Columbia, he served as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia and later as the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. Mr. Holder is currently a partner at the law firm of Covington & Burling, and he is the chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, an organization focused on stemming the tide of gerrymandering.
So in this episode, Eric gives us his perspective on the proper functioning of the Department of Justice, the balance between independence and political accountability, and a distinction between the role of the AG as the chief prosecutor on the one hand and as legal advisor to the president and sometimes to the National Security Council on the other hand. He also remembers his own experience with congressional oversight and gives us a very frank assessment of how oversight is functioning today, including in particular an assessment of Devin Nunes, formerly the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Eric also critiques the two OLC opinions against indicting a sitting president, and he offers predictions about the Mueller report and his own upcoming decision on whether he's going to run for president.
It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 395, Eric Holder on the Rule of Law.
Eric Holder, welcome to the podcast.
It's good to be here and good to talk to you.
So let's begin with some questions about the importance of law enforcement independence from political interference. The DOJ is one of the unique cabinet agencies in this respect. Why is it important for DOJ and the FBI to be treated differently than other parts of the federal government that answer to the president and the White House?
Well, the powers that the Justice Department has and the component agencies within the Justice Department, the DEA, the ATF, obviously the FBI, have the ability to take people's liberty from them, to take property from them in a way that other agencies do not. And you want to make sure that through the use of that law enforcement power, that things are decided on the basis of the facts and on the law, and that there is not any kind of political influence or direction as to how that power is used. You know, I remember when I was up for confirmation talking to Pat Leahy, who was then the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he said, you have to understand that you're going to be the Attorney General of the United States. You're not going to be the Secretary of Justice. And I remember that's always kind of stuck with me, that, you know, the Justice Department is really separate and apart from all of the other cabinet agencies. You know, as Attorney General, you're part of the administration, you're part of the president's cabinet, but as head of the Justice Department, the Attorney General is really different from all the other cabinet members.
And when you were AG, did that make you feel different, say, when you ended up in a White House meeting with other cabinet officials? I mean, did you set yourself apart or did you feel set apart by that?
Yeah, I think you do. You certainly felt that when you were in the cabinet room and the whole cabinet was there. Again, you're a team player, or you're part of a team, and yet you feel a little different, and you're supposed to feel a little different. It's interesting, though, when you're in the Situation Room, I don't think that the notion of difference was as great there. Then you're part of the national security team, and you may have a unique role. You know, you're opining about the merits of an operation, a policy. But then you have to come in every now and again as the chief lawyer for the administration and talk about, well, you know, operationally we can do this, but legally we don't have a good basis to do that which we have all agreed, we might want to do, and we might have to think about an alternative mechanism to employ.
That's interesting. So distinguishing between the sort of core prosecutorial functions on the one hand and the legal advisory role on the other hand in that setting.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. On the national security side, you really do have – you do wear two hats coming from the Justice Department, as you well know. You are a part of the national security team, and so you're making operational suggestions, operational decisions. But as the – coming from the Justice Department, you're also thinking about legality and whether or not something can be done. Even though you might have just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean that you actually should.
And Eric, for our listeners, what's the source of these principles and distinctions that you've been talking about between DOJ and other agencies, between the prosecutorial function and the legal function or advisory function, between something that is, operationally feasible, but legally not so great? I mean, what's the source of the rules and distinctions that you've just been talking about? Is it all written down in a statute book somewhere, or where do we find it if we want to look it up?
Well, I don't think you can really look it up. I mean, we're talking about kind of norms here, practices here, what history teaches us. I mean, history, I think, teaches us that justice departments that become too close to the White House frequently run into problems, probably most famously, during, the Watergate scandal. But there have been other times when the Justice Department has had bumps along the way when that wall, for lack of a better term, is not high enough between the Justice Department and the White House. So history teaches us that. And then a lot of it is just really, it's a question of practice. I started at the Justice Department straight out of law school at a thing called the Public Integrity Section in the Criminal Division. And it was drilled into us by people who were my, deputy section chiefs, my section chief, that you never were to allow political influence into any of the decision making that you had to make. And that is just something that I think everybody within the department and, the Bureau, the ATF, the DEA, these are the kinds of things that people just feel, they know. But if you ask that question of them, and the one that you've asked of me, well, give me a piece of paper that lays this out, I'm not sure, everybody would just kind of shrug and kind of stumble in the way that I am now and saying, well, this is just the way in which we're supposed to operate. And there's peer pressure. It's an interesting thing. Some of my, there are Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals in the department. But certainly when I was at the Public Integrity Section, especially, conversations about things political was just not something that people did. Now, that might be different now, given the environment in which we find ourselves as a nation, the greater degree of polarization that we have. But a good friend of mine who was a deputy chief and then became chief of the Public Integrity Section, a guy named Lee Radick, who's passed away. I worked with Lee for, I don't know, maybe 8-9 years before I found out that he was a Republican. I mean, I had no idea. And that's just, it's a small example of the way in which, things political are just not a part of the way in which things are done at the Justice Department.
Yeah.
You talked a short while ago about the fact that you were also part of a team. And in fact, you were a political appointee of the president's. And is part of the goal here to create some kind of political accountability as well, to try to keep law enforcement on the right track and abiding by these rules, carrying out their responsibilities appropriately? And if that is part of the goal, how do you strike the right balance between maintaining a certain level of independence between or from the president and others, and remaining accountable to the people?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Nate. I think that, you know, I wouldn't say, I'm not sure I would focus on it as being something political as much as, you know, an administration can come in, a president can come in and set, you know, broad parameters, broad policy directions. We're going to be, you know, somebody, a president could come in and say that we're going to really, you know, focus on, you know, narcotics enforcement. We're going to deal with the opioid crisis. And, you know, and so I want my attorney general, I want my Justice Department to, you know, muster its forces and its abilities to really get at that problem. I think that's totally, you know, appropriate. But if you start to go a little further than that and say, well, I want you to, you know, potentially say, you know, I need you to go after, you know, this company or something like that, or you know, do something with this particular industry in this particular way. You know, I think you can get things in broad strokes from the political components of the administration, but in terms of effectuating those, putting into reality those broad strokes, that's best left to the Attorney General and the people who serve with the Attorney General in the Justice Department. Even though those people are political appointees, I think those attorneys general, assistant attorneys general, you know, like David, who really understand that difference. You know, I'm a political appointee, but I understand that my role at the Justice Department is different than other political appointees in other agencies. Those are the people who I think do the best and who serve the Justice Department the best and who ultimately serve the country the best.
And is that line between policy, strategy, and sort of overall performance on the one hand and individual enforcement actions on the other, is that always a stark line that's clear, or do those things bleed together at times?
Well, I have to say that I jealously guarded the Justice Department's independence while I was AG. President Obama, I think, understood that the best Justice Departments are the ones that are the most independent. I actually think that in some ways the Obama White House overreacted, perhaps, to what they had seen happen during the Bush years. And I think that they put the wall up a little too high. I think there were things that we certainly could have talked about, could have had more interaction about than we did. And there were times when I'd say, well, you know, I want to share something with you, and they'd be a little hesitant about that. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, President Obama and I are friends, and we have a, you know, our wives are friends. We have, you know, a good personal relationship. And yet, while I was his attorney general, there were things that happened within the department that I could not, did not share with him. You know, some of the things that he would then read about, you know, in the newspaper, if I thought we could not give them, you know, a heads up. Some of the things they would hear from the White House would hear, you know, 24 hours before we were announcing some kind of enforcement action. But decisions made within the Justice Department that were only, you know, the existence of that decision was only shared with the White House after the decision had been made. And that was kind of normal within the Obama administration.
Was that a challenge for you to navigate that relationship? Did it put stress on your friendship and your personal relationship with him at all?
No, I don't think so. I mean, as I said, I think that he understood that as Attorney General, I was in a different position than other cabinet members. You know, we could still argue about, you know, the merits of Chicago basketball as opposed to New York basketball. I mean, he still labors under the mistaken belief that the best ball is played in Chicago for some unknown reason.
Confirmation hearing, Eric.
yeah, we could talk about those kinds of things and the relationships. So, you know, how our relationships are going with our wives, you know, things like that, and even more substantive conversations. We could have political conversations, but there were certain lines that we both knew that we just couldn't cross. You know, I think about the decision that I made to not defend the Defense of Marriage Act. And that was a big decision. We had a split Justice Department, and I decided we weren't going to defend DOMA. And I thought to myself, this is not something that the President of the United States should read about in the newspapers. And so I remember we were at the White House for a Super Bowl party, and I told him that this is the decision that that I had made. And his reply to me, I remember, was, you know, well, you know, I was he was trying to think of a way in which he could convey to me that he didn't want the Defense of Marriage Act defended, but he never did. I mean, he never did, thinking that that would be inappropriate, but we ended up, you know, in the same place. And I think that was another thing. I mean, you know, he appointed me as Attorney General, having known me for, you know, I guess a couple of years, a few years, and we shared a worldview. So I don't think that he had to worry that I was going to be doing anything that was going to be far from where he would want his Justice Department to be.
So he never, like, had you over for dinner and asked you for a loyalty pledge or anything like that, just by way of example?
No. As I've read about some of the things that Attorney General Sessions and I guess other members of the administration have had to deal with, that is so different from the way in which Attorney General Holder interacted with President Obama, between how different the Obama Justice Department interacted with the Obama White House. These are fundamentally different things. These are things that are, as I read about them, and assuming that they're true, they're just hard for me to even comprehend. It's just kind of mind blowing to think that actually those things could happen and define a relationship between the White House and the Trump White House and the Trump Justice Department.
Let's talk about a few of those things. Maybe we'll try to put them in broad categories or something to make it a little bit easier. I mean, we have situations where the president has allegedly asked the Justice Department to stand down on investigating or prosecuting certain people. He's also reportedly, and in some cases publicly, called on the department to investigate his political opponents or even people who are cooperating in the Mueller investigation. And then you also have the president just publicly calling into question the integrity of specific individuals in law enforcement, from political appointees to career folks, and questioning their integrity and independence. And I'm wondering, I guess, first question is, do you think the public reaction to any of those things has been an overreaction? Are there some of those things that he's done that that don't cause you concern?
No, I don't think that the public reaction has been an overreaction. In fact, I'm a little concerned that we're becoming numb to things that I think are really fundamentally dangerous. To have a president of the United States question the integrity of organizations that have served this nation well, not without fault. I mean, the FBI, I'm thinking about the FBI, you know, has obviously had a history where it has not always been on the side of right. But to question the integrity of the FBI, and then to, you know, go in within the organization and question the integrity of agents or, directors, deputy directors of the FBI, that is, that's unprecedented. And I think, as I said, it's dangerous, especially in conjunction with the other things that you mentioned about, you know, don't prosecute, don't go after, certain people, do prosecute, you know, Hillary Clinton, do an investigation of somebody. Again, these are the kinds of things that are unprecedented and I think really are scary, are dangerous. That's not how we as a nation have functioned. It's not consistent with the way in which I think presidents have used the enormous power that they have. I can't think of another president. You know, Nixon, certainly. But, you know, he, as corrupt as he was in that regard, I'm not sure it has reached the level to which Trump has taken himself. And then, and, you know, the Trump thing is that Nixon, I guess, is doing things in the privacy of the Oval Office. You know, this president is doing things publicly through tweets or those, I guess, press gaggles or whatever they're called as he's walking, you know, to the helicopter, because he never does formal press conferences.
Yeah. So just to follow up on that, Eric, I mean, you know, some people say that Richard Nixon at least had the decency to do his corruption in secret, or at least to try, although he forgot that he was taping everything that he was saying in the Oval Office. But what?
Whoops.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, one of the things that characterizes.
Well, you know what's interesting about that?
Yeah.
David, you know, I mean, yeah, he did it in the secrecy of the Oval Office because he knew, Nixon knew that what he was doing was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, Trump does these things publicly. And maybe he just doesn't give a damn about whether or not, you know, people think that he knows he's doing something wrong, or he simply doesn't understand that what he's doing is wrong. Now, early on, I think you could have argued that this was lack of familiarity, given he had not had much government experience, lack of familiarity with the ways in which government operates. But I think we're past that point now. And some of the things that, you know, Andy McCabe has talked about, I guess, with the introduction of his book in the last week or so, things that Jim Comey talked about, I think show a president who is hell-bent on bending, you know, the law enforcement apparatus to his, bend it in a way that is beneficial to him and protects people who are close to him. And, you know, he's doing things in a corrupt way. And I say this, you know, I understand what I'm saying here. You know, the president of the United States is acting in a corrupt way. It's taken me a long time to get to the point where I could say that and feel comfortable saying that. But I think the record now is pretty clear that that's the way in which this president comports himself.
And you don't, I mean, I have no brief to file for Donald Trump on this by any means, of course, but just to sort of take up what limited defense I have seen advanced on his behalf by supporters or other apologists, they have said things like, well, you know, this open and notorious tweeting that he's doing, because it's so obvious and out in the open, and because it isn't a sort of a one-to-one communication with the attorney general or some other official, you know, that's just Trump being Trump, and it shouldn't be taken seriously, or it shouldn't be taken as a sign of bad intent or anything. You're not in the same place as those hypothetical defenders of the president, I take it.
No, I wouldn't be. And, you know, in a prosecution of a person who is doing these things in the way that the president has done them, I'd be more than glad to argue for the prosecution, and would not want to be the defense attorney who was trying to convince a jury that because these things were open and notorious, they were not an indication of, you know, any kind of corrupt intent. I think in some ways, you know, those assertions are kind of laughable.
Although in a way they may contribute to the sort of numbing effect that you have described, which is...
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there are, you know, almost on a weekly basis, I don't know, sometimes even on a daily basis, we have things that would have been seen as major scandals. I mean, major scandals within other administrations. And with this administration, the life cycle of something that would be major in another one and would go on for, you know, weeks, months, is 24 hours. And then the next day, you're on to whatever the next outrage is.
So do you think then, you mentioned this a moment ago, do you think firing the FBI director, as Trump obviously did with Comey, can constitute obstruction of justice? Or, you know, is that just a personnel call that couldn't be obstruction because it's within the president's power?
No, I mean, clearly he has the power to fire the FBI director, and that cannot be reversed. I mean, that's fine. He could fire Jim Comey. But then the question is, why did you fire Jim Comey? Now, is it a policy difference? a personality conflict, you know, oh, that's fine. But if you fired Jim Comey with the intent of derailing an investigation of you or people near around you, or just an investigation more generally, I think that the lawful exercise of presidential power can lead to an obstruction charge. The question really is, what was the president's intention when he did something that he had the power to do?
Okay. When you were AG, we've already sort of established that President Obama never gave you one of those offers you can't refuse kinds of calls or so forth. But did you have situations where you had to take an ethics-based recusal because of some financial interest or other kind of interest you might have had? And how hard was that for you to figure out what to do and then to do it if you had to step aside from a matter?
Yeah, you know, I think about the recusals that I had, David, and they were more often that subject matter things. For instance, well, subject matter, I mean, I was recused from anything, for instance, that Covington and Burling was involved in, recused from anything where I had represented, you know, a corporation, something along those lines. I remember I was recused from the AP leaks case because I had spoken to one of the reporters, I guess, who was might have gotten the classified information. I remember I got interviewed in connection with that investigation. There were times when I, you know, recused myself. I mean, then we had standing recusals, I guess, with regard to, as I said, Covington, you know, related matters. But, you know, that's the way you have to do it. I mean, because the reality is justice departments are not effective. Law enforcement is not effective if you are seen to be favoring one side or the other, if you're seen to be politically motivated. And, you know, you don't want to have the attorney general, deputy attorney general, or assistant attorneys general, recusing themselves unnecessarily. It is something that you do only after, you know, careful thought. But there are times when you simply have to say it is good for a substantive reason, or it's good for perception that I not be involved in a particular matter.
I want to ask you about something that happened in the Situation Room in the 2011-2012 time frame.
Am I going to be able to talk about this? Something happened in the Situation Room?
I'll keep it vague.
All right.
So you know that time with the thing and the place with the other guy, and then we did that thing?
Yeah.
You said were okay guy with that, right? Doing it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got that. I'm sure your listeners understand exactly what we're talking about.
There were a series of deputies committee meetings involving a question of how transparent the White House and the Justice Department should be with the American people on something. And there was a lot of hand-wringing. It ultimately went to a principals committee meeting. And I remember as they were going around the table, there was hand-wringing at the PC level as well. And it ultimately got to you. And one of the biggest equities in the discussion involved litigation risk. And you actually came out quite strongly in favor of being transparent, despite what you thought was manageable but existing risk to DOJ's equities. And I'm just wondering what transparency meant to you, why you tended to lean pretty far into being transparent with the American people. And I think that's something you shared with the president himself. And I'm just wondering why that was and what role that played in the rule of law.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, transparency should be the default. I mean, to the extent that if you're making a decision in a national security sphere, antitrust sphere, criminal division, you know, to the extent that you have the ability to explain to the American people can see what it is that you are doing and why you are doing it, that I think engenders confidence in the Justice Department, makes the Justice Department ultimately more effective. If people believe in our system of justice, if people believe in the Justice Department, if they believe in FBI agents, they're much more likely to cooperate with the people in law enforcement, share information with people in law enforcement. I also think that's just kind of the way government is supposed to be run. I mean, at the end of the day, you might be, you know, an attorney general of the United States, and you've got a security detail, and you fly on a Gulfstream. but you serve the American people. Your check says, you know, United States government on it, and it comes from the hard-earned money of the American people, and so you owe an obligation to them to the extent possible to share information. And if that entails risks, well, you try to manage those risks. Now, there are certain things that, you know, having said that, people need to understand that governments need to operate at times where things cannot be shared, you know, national security, some national security issues, covert actions that are taken and that are in the best interests of the nation. There's a certain trust that the American people have to put into those who serve in government. But, you know, the basis of that trust to allow people to operate in the shadows when that is necessary, I think is really generated by, or the foundation of that is almost that transparency. You know, if people, the American people think, well, you know, whenever they can, they're sharing with us, they're being transparent with us, and we understand there are going to be certain areas where they're not going to be able to be, but we'll let them do that. If, on the other hand, you are secretive all the time, it is hard then to get the running room that you need when you're going to try to do something where you can't share information.
Yeah. Let's talk about the people's representatives for a minute, the good and the bad. I suspect that you, had some interactions with Congress during your time as AG that you wouldn't describe as particularly enjoyable.
You were
the subject of quite a bit of oversight, as were others in the administration. And, you know, we saw the pendulum swing quite dramatically after Trump was elected, where a Republican Congress seemed pretty reluctant to investigate him at all, really, and instead viewed their job often as being to rehabilitate him publicly. And I'm just wondering, you know, you've seen the good and the bad of congressional oversight. What is the right balance to strike there with Congress? Yeah. And how do you keep politics out of it when it's an inherently political branch?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, oversight is really an important part of our system of government. This notion of checks and balances, that's one of the ways in which Congress, again, through the legitimate use of oversight, can make sure that the executive branch is operating correctly. It also promotes that notion of transparency we just talked about. But if you look at the ways in which the Republicans in these last end of the Obama administration or during the Obama administration, the beginning of the Trump administration, I mean, you see oversight just run amok when it came to the Obama administration. You know, when I came up and testified, I don't know, like 10 times about Fast and Furious. They focused on Benghazi, you know, IRS, trying to make scandals of things that, weren't, or tried to involve people at high levels in the administration who were not involved. And then, you know, January 2017, Trump becomes president, and these same Republicans go silent. And in the face of, you know, corruption, the likes of which we have not seen since Nixon, Republicans in the House and the Senate really didn't do any of the things that you would expect a responsible Congress to do. And I'd go so far as to say their inaction ultimately made them complicit in the things that I think history will judge the Trump administration so harshly about.
So, Eric, but it's true what you said. But on the other hand, in one area, at least, the Republicans in Congress, in the House, especially during the beginning years of the Trump administration, were extremely active. And that was in, you can call it, oversight of the FBI and DOJ with respect to certain investigations, including the Carter Page FISA, and you have all the shenanigans with Chairman Nunes. So, I mean, what's your sense of how House intelligence acquitted itself during those first 2 years under the leadership of Devin Nunes?
I would say that was an embarrassment. It was a total embarrassment. You know, you and I would go to the intel committees. that was the one place where you could go. There are no TV cameras. Dutch Ruppersberger was there, you know, and Rogers. And, you know, we might have ideological differences, Rogers and I, but I never felt that when I was in that, you know, that secure room with all the committee members, that we were doing anything other than, you know, legitimate oversight, really sincere interactions about the ways in which we were doing things, or requests for information about the ways in which we were doing things. Nunes, you know, what he did by going after the FBI, you know, by probing into the investigation, and as best I can tell, potentially, you know, sharing that information with people at the White House, that really is a total misuse of the power that he had as chairman. And again, it's inconsistent with the ways in which that role has traditionally been has been used. And I got to tell you that, you know, I don't know. I don't, you know, obviously not, don't have all of the facts, but it will be interesting for me to see, you know, what a Mueller report looks like and what it is that they find, if anything, about the role that Nunes played in connection with, you know, ferrying information to the White House about pending investigations. I think that's something that has to be looked at, has to be examined.
Okay, so Eric, as we're recording this, you know, there are fevered predictions that the Mueller report is imminently forthcoming, but by the time this episode drops in the public, we may already know. Do you want to share with us any predictions as to either the form, the substance, or other aspects of the Mueller quote-unquote report or output?
You know, I think people, I'm not, I might be totally wrong about this, but I'm not so sure. There could be a Mueller report that does not necessarily mean that the Mueller investigation is over. You know, the Mueller report could answer some of the questions that were a part of his original charge. But you still got, you know, at least you got the Roger Stone trial that has to go on. There may be other, you know, cases that come about if Stone decides to cooperate, if Manafort decides to cooate. And so a report could be prepared and the work of the Mueller team could have to continue. Now, I don't know, maybe Bob Mueller leaves and maybe, you know, somebody then takes his place as the head of this special counsel's office. It just seems to me that, you know, we shouldn't think that the provision of a report necessarily means that that office has completed all of the things that it is going to be responsible for doing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's definitely noticeable about the Paul Mueller investigation thus far is the way in which he's acted almost like a startup incubator. Right. And has spun right. out all these separate lines of business to the U.S. Attorney's Office to handle, including, say, the Cohen matter in New York and other matters that EDVA and D.C. Yep. have picked up.
Well, I think that's right. And those things will live on, you know, long after, even if the Mueller shop were to close up, you know, next week. What's going on in the Eastern District of Virginia, what's going on, especially in the Southern District of New York, those things will continue. Those things will last. And those things, I think, in some ways, you know, people say those are the most dangerous things. If you've got people looking at a president for obstruction of justice or conspiring with a foreign power to influence an election, I don't think it's more serious than that. And that's what Bob Mueller is looking at. But these other things, you know, campaign contribution violations, those are serious, are serious as well. And so I think this president has got should have concerns on a whole bunch of fronts about what is being investigated and will continue to be investigated.
Okay. Well, we will see what the future brings, and then we can rate your predictions against that. So let's go back for a sec to DOJ and the sort of the interactions between political officials on the one hand, career folks on the other. You, like me, you know, started in the honor program as a line attorney and, as you said, sort of had all the politics beaten out of you from an early age. The career employees at DOJ, though, they have political views, obviously.
Sure.
In your experience, I guess, first, did you feel like they were always able to set those views aside, or did you, as one of them, or later, you know, as a political official overseeing them, ever sort of feel like you saw areas in which people might be leaning on the wheel based on their personal political views?
No, I never really saw that. And, you know, people say, oh, that can't possibly be true. But I think it really is. I've never really seen, you know, an investigation predicated on some kind of political leaning, you know, by an, you know, by prosecutors or something like that, or a prosecution decision made on the basis of or pushed by, you know, a political determination. I mean, you know, there are thousands of people within the department who do hold, you know, some probably more strongly than others, you know, political views. But I've never really been faced with a situation where I thought that decisions were being made on a political basis. Now, I will make, you know, I'm even going a little too far there. There were a couple of things. There were a couple of cases. Let me think about a case involved, well, one case where I think a politically appointed U.S. attorney in a prior administration, I think, wanted to bring a case, or was a little pushing a case that I thought might have had something to do with politics. It was interesting because it was a matter that I was recused from, so I could only observe that from outside.
And how did you relate to the career officials when you were there? I mean, did you remind them that you were one of them, or did you try to maintain a certain distance, or how did you sort of treat them?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, when I was a line guy, we used to kiddingly call the political appointees tourists. You know, yeah. So they're here, and they you know, they get their little passports, and they get their little stamp or something, but they leave, and we really run this department. And I remember, you know, saying that as a line guy, but I remember thinking about that when I came back to the department, both as deputy, as U.S. attorney, as attorney general, that, you know, you had to make sure that to the extent people had any concerns about you as a political appointee, you had to allay those concerns by involving the career people in decision making, show them the appropriate respect. You certainly wouldn't do the Trumpian kinds of things where you go after people, question their integrity. And I think, you know, it'll be for others to decide. I think I had a good relationship with the career folks. They might not have always agreed with me on, you know, policy decisions that I made or directions I wanted to take the department. But I don't think people thought that what I was doing was improperly motivated. You know, disagree with me, you know, but I don't think people would say that he wasn't doing this for appropriate, if wrong, reasons.
So we know what Mueller did when he saw these text messages between Pete Strzok and Lisa Page. Did you ever see anything remotely like that when you were there? And what would you have done, do you think, if you were confronted with that by career employees doing the investigations they were doing?
Well, you mean where they're expressing these strong political yeah. views? Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing. I've not seen that, and B, to the extent that I would, you would have immediately pulled those people off of that investigation. I mean, you just cannot have, you know, it's one thing for people to have strong political views and have the ability to hopefully put them aside and just judge things on the basis of, you know, the facts and the law, but with that. Those emails, that email chain, it would be too much to have the American people believe, given what they said and how they said it, that these folks were operating in a totally appropriate way. Now, I don't take from what I'm saying that I believe that they acted inappropriately or that they did things on the basis of politics. But the perception there was just too bad. You would have to remove them from that investigative team.
Yeah. One of the things in the midst of the Mueller investigation that's been extensively debated in the public is whether or not the president can be indicted while he's in office. I'm wondering, you know, I'm not asking you to offer up a you know, detailed legal opinion on this or call into question OLC's existing opinion. But I'm wondering, do you think, what do you think the right answer should be?
Yeah, let's just go there. I mean, I think that the OLC opinions are wrong. You know, there's one, I guess, from the Watergate era, and then I guess one from the latter part of the Clinton administration. And, you know, I've read those opinions. And I remember looking at them while it was still AG. It was one of those deals. I had some free time, and I remember wanted to look at them. And I remember looking at them then and thinking, you know, this notion that you can't indict the president essentially because you will paralyze, you know, the executive branch, just doesn't, to me, hold water, given the fact that, you know, the executive branch can function with a president who's going to be dealing with, you know, potentially a criminal matter involving him. If a president is going to be involved, for instance, in impeachment, that's a pretty paralyzing thing. And yet, you know, the executive branch goes on. It also doesn't take into account, it seems to me, the 25th Amendment, where if it is something that really takes up the president's time so much, the president could, you know, take himself out of office, let the vice president serve as acting president, and then come back, presumably, if there was, you know, an acquittal or something along those lines. You know, and when you look at, I was looking at just Rachel Maddow and the show that she had, and it was interesting how they delved into the formulation of that first OLC memo, where they were more concerned about coming up with a way in which they could say that they could prosecute Agnew, and just try to draw a distinction, try to say, well, we can prosecute Agnew because Agnew is not as central to the executive branch as the president is. But the focus was on Agnew, and they were trying to come up with a way in which they could differentiate Agnew from Nixon. And so one of the people who was involved in the formulation of the opinion says, well, you know, the stuff about Nixon was like dicta, as we say. The focus of that opinion was really on Agnew. And I think that just is consistent with my view that there is a way in which a president could be indicted and the executive branch could continue to function. And especially when you look at this president, who's like, you know, he's got, what, 50-60% of his time is executive time, whatever that means, you know. I mean, so it's not as if he were dealing with a criminal matter, he could still be watching Fox and Friends and whatever else he does.
Well, that's a comforting hypothetical to some, I'm sure. We do want to ask you a little bit about your life after DOJ, but I have one last question. As we've asked some other guests this, I think I know the answer, but I want to ask you too. Okay. There's been a lot of arguing back and forth, chiefly during the Obama administration, although you see the issue arising even more recently, about the effectiveness of the civilian criminal justice system as a tool for dealing with international terrorism. And I just want to get, you know, your sense of the relative strengths and weaknesses and what the case, you know, is for, the use of the civilian criminal justice Article III court system as against military commissions or law of war detention when it comes to dealing with terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have great faith in our Article III courts. We have seen them handle the toughest cases safely, fairly, and hold people accountable and put people in jail for extended periods of time, you know, that they deserved. And the way in which during the Obama years that became a political issue, you know, politicized the use of Article III courts, is something that, again, I think people who are on the other side of that argument are not going to be treated very kindly by history. You know, when I said that we ought to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the architects of the 9/11 attack in federal court in Manhattan in the Southern District of New York, that set off, there was initially some support, and then you know, that support eroded. And here we are 18 years later, and you know, those people are still alive, still in Guantanamo, still untried, where if we had allowed to happen what I had recommended, they would have been tried, they would have been convicted, and they would probably be just a memory now. And that lack of faith in a system that has been proven to be more than adequate, I mean, to be, you know, just outstanding, that lack of faith in that system really has allowed the people who were most responsible for the biggest terrorist attack in the history of this country and on our soil to go unpunished. And that is something that, from my perspective, is simply, you know, unforgivable. That's politics run amok. And when politicians get involved in law enforcement decisions, this is the kind of stuff that you see happen.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your time since you left the Department of Justice. I'll assume that you had a number of different opportunities available to you, but one of the things you decided to take on was the fight against gerrymandering. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about why that in particular is so important to you and how that fight is going.
Yeah, I'm the chair of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, and I chose to be involved in that because it seemed to me it was a continuation of the work that I did as Attorney General, where I really wanted to, I focused a lot of attention on the protection of voting rights. If you look at our system of the way in which we redistrict here and the way which we have redistricted here in the last cycle in 2011, you see partisan gerrymandering, the likes of which Princeton did a study, the likes of which we haven't seen for, you know, the last 50 years. And you see state legislatures and Congress, that is bodies that are not representative of the desires of the people, where you have, you know, I don't know, you look at a state, for instance, like Pennsylvania, that before we filed a lawsuit, you had a congressional delegation. It was 13 Republicans, 5 Democrats. After we filed our lawsuit and lines were redrawn in an appropriate way, you now have a delegation that is 9-9 Republicans, 9 Democrats. And you see the same things in Ohio and North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan, Texas, Florida. And so it seemed to me that what we want to do is to make the redistricting effort that we're going to have in 2021 a fair one. Not to, and I always try to make this clear to people, not to gerrymander for Democrats, but to just make this fair. Because I actually think, as a Democrat, that if we make this fair, that, you know, make this a battle between conservatives and Republicans against Democrats and progressives and who's got the best ideas, who's got the best policies, who's got the best vision for the future, that Democrats and progressives will do just fine. And so that's what we have been trying to do, to come up with ways in which, through, you know, lawsuits, promotion of these independent commissions, supporting candidates who will stand for fair redistricting, that's what we have been trying to do, all again with the aim of trying to make our system simply more fair.
One last question for you. You know, we've seen at departments and agencies throughout our history, when they've gotten themselves into trouble and run amok, one of the solutions is often to bring in a well-respected judge, former judge or law enforcement officer to run things. And, you know, in light of what's going on in the Oval Office right now, you know, people may be thinking that's a sensible solution to the 2020 election. Is there anything you want to share with us about your plans?
You gave us a Mueller prediction, so we just thought we should ask for this, too.
I was wondering where Nate's question was going on that one. I'm thinking, bringing a judge in? All right. I'm thinking, I thought you were going to ask me, do I want to go back to the Justice Department or something like that? No, I mean, I've said that I am thinking about running in 2020, and I'm still in that process. I'm near the end of that process, and I'll make my decision known, you know, relatively soon. Although I will say this, you know, it's an interesting thing. You hear people all the time say, it's a family decision. You have to take into account, you know, the wishes of your family. And, you know, I always said, yeah, right. But that really is true in a way that I've not seen at other times in my career where, you know, I don't know, if I wanted to be attorney general, if I wanted to be deputy attorney general, if I wanted to be U.S. attorney. My wife kids me that, you know, after she met me, every job I took, I took a cut in pay, and she kept thinking, I didn't marry you to, you know, go down the economic ladder here. But I kind of made those decisions, and I didn't, you know, we talked about them a little bit, but it wasn't like I was, you know, I took into account what Sharon said, kinda, but I did what I wanted to do. This is different. This is different. I mean, a campaign would involve them in a way that you have to take into consideration. And then, you know, if you were in the White House, I've seen what, you know, what it's like up close, what it's like for a president, a first lady, and their kids to have to deal with. So this really is something that will, the decision will ultimately be, you know, something that I will have a part in, a significant part in, maybe even the majority part in, but the families has to be, their wishes have to be taken into account as well.
Okay. Well, we will await the final decision of you and Doc Malone when the time is right. And Eric Holder, thank you very much for being with us today. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Eric Holder for making time to join us by phone. If you haven't yet, please share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.